This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars, episode 79, was recorded on November 18th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by TopTradersOnPlug.com, which happens to be my own favorite podcast when it comes to quant and rules-based investing. Check them out. You'll be glad you did. Louis Vincent Gav, co-founder of GavCal Capital, headquartered in Hong Kong, joins me as today's feature interview guest. And Louis, although both you and I are not in Hong Kong today, although we're both legal residents of Hong Kong, there is really escalating news there. Now, you and I both know Hong Kong to be one of the most civilized and nonviolent places in the world. That's one of the things that I really like about it. But we have the police violently storming Hong Kong Polytechnic University, students throwing Molotov cocktails, showering police vehicles in flames, and just horrific pictures that we're seeing on the internet. One police officer shot through the leg with an arrow shot by a student using a bow and arrow. What the heck is going on that has turned this pro-democracy protest in Hong Kong so violent? Because it seems to me like by resorting to this kind of violence, the protesters are almost inviting a violent escalation from the Chinese government. I would think that their interests would be better served by less violent modes of protest. What do you think is going on which has caused this to take such a violent turn?
Well, first of all, thanks again for having me, Eric. It's always great to catch up. Look, I think we can take this conversation in so many different directions. The first point I'd make, of course, is that, of course, everybody regrets the violence. But the first point to highlight is the violence is, you know, very limited and basically right now around the Poly U campus. The rest of Hong Kong remains completely safe. And, you know, this has been going on for almost 6 months now. And yes, to your point, Hong Kong is a very nonviolent place. Historically, it has been very nonviolent. And I would say even in their violence, which, you know, we are seeing today, the place remains, frankly, fairly nonviolent, even in their violence, if that makes sense. You know, when you do indeed see the scenes unfolding at Poly U right now, when you see, you know, the kids shooting arrows, when you see the kids throwing Molotov cocktails, in most other countries in the world, whether the U.S., whether Europe, etc., people who would do that would usually get shot. You know, try throwing a Molotov cocktail at a U.S. cop, and you're going to end up riddled with bullets. And so even for a situation that has been violent, there have been, unfortunately, now been a couple deaths. But in the whole scheme of things, Hong Kong remains an extremely safe place. So that's, you know, I think that's the first point to be made. You know, why now? I think one point to highlight is come November 24th, there's an election in Hong Kong for district councillors. And here, I think there's a sort of arms race between the two camps to almost show how horrible the other camp is. So the pro-democrats, the pro-democracy, the, you know, the students, the high school students, et cetera, want to highlight both how cruel the police is and how incompetent the Hong Kong leaders have been, which is true. They've dealt with this crisis really, really badly on one side. And then I think on the government side, the view is, if we show the students to be completely irresponsible and violent, et cetera, there'll be a big turnout for law and order, for the lack of a better word. And people, even though the government is unpopular, people might show up to vote for the government, if only because they want all of this to stop. And so I think we're now, in essence, in the money time between now and this weekend, where, you know, there's this ratcheting up of violence almost on both sides to basically convince voters that the other side is just too dangerous to be trusted. Hopefully, you know, we have an answer on November 24th, which will allow one camp to accept defeat and one camp to claim victory. Obviously, if the government wins, which to me seems the most likely, I think there'll be a big turnout on the vote, and most of the Hong Kong people want this now to be over with. And so against their wishes, they're almost going to vote a pro-government ticket just to get this over with. That's my belief, but I could be completely wrong. We'll know in a week. If that turns out to be the case, then the government will have the political legitimacy to tell the students, look, enough is enough now, back to school, and we'll prosecute the guys who've been violent. If the pro-democracy wins, it's hard to see how the government avoids the main request of the protesters, which is a police inquiry, and at the same time, a restart of talk about how to move Hong Kong towards democracy. Now, one last thing on your point, that the students are almost inviting a response by China. I think fundamentally that's what a number of them want. They actually don't want to be fighting the Hong Kong police. A number of them want to be fighting the Chinese PLA because they see the Chinese Communist Party as a source of deep evil and an illegitimate government for China. So, you know, if you see yourself as a freedom fighter, if you see yourself as the vanguard of the revolution that will topple the Chinese Communist Party, then you want to fight the PLA. I think that's how a lot of the students see themselves. So they do want to bring on the Chinese army. But of course, I think an intervention by the Chinese army is highly, highly, highly unlikely for this very reason.
Louis, let's expand this conversation now, both beyond Hong Kong and also beyond the current events, and talk about some of the economic consequences and causes and what we can expect from all this. We know about this situation in Hong Kong, which originally arose out of the extradition bill. In France, the Gilets Jaunes movement originally began over an increase in gas taxes, but I think almost everyone agrees that was the straw that broke the camel's back. It's not about gasoline taxes. It was something reached a tipping point, and that was the proximal catalyst that got it there. In the case of Chile, the protests there began over a completely inconsequential increase in subway fares in Santiago, less than a nickel difference in fare, but it was the straw that broke the camel's back, and now we see all across Chile people are burning things down. Lebanon, you know, we've got all over the world these things are happening. I just saw the Joker movie, which came out, and in some ways that main character really is almost being idolized as someone who's just so fed up with the elites and the rich that, I mean, he's depicted as a crazy guy, which he is, but he actually kind of gets a lot of public support as he goes on a rampage killing rich people. So it seems like all around the world, we've got people that are fed up with the status quo and particularly with the political elite and the wealthy. What does this mean? What does history teach us that we should expect from all this? What are the economic implications? Where is it all headed from here?
Well, look, I grew up in France. And so you can take the boy out of France, but you can't take the Karl Marx out of the boy. You know, having been raised in the French educational system, I was basically force-fed a big dose of Marxist catechism. And, you know, you can fault Marx for a lot, and especially most of his economic theories turned out to be wrong. But in his study of history, I think Marx makes two very good points. And the first point is that most revolutions occur because of inflation. In essence, inflation is a deeply destabilizing force. Now, of course, you could say, well, we don't have inflation anywhere in the world today. We don't have inflation, and you know, because we keep being told that if you strip this out and if you strip that out and if you strip that out, prices are falling. But, you know, you highlight the strike in Santiago. It did erupt over an increase in subway fares. You highlight the yellow jackets. It did occur over a rise in petrol taxes. You know, here in Hong Kong, I think it's reductive to say that this is the Hong Kong problem is all about real estate. But the fact that young people can't hope to ever own real estate and hope to ever basically be really part of society in Hong Kong has to have played something in it. You know, one of the slogans of the young people is, what do I care if I go to jail? The jail cell will still be bigger than my apartment. And so, you know, you look all around the world. And yes, I think one of the issues we are confronting is, everywhere you care to look, people are told there's no inflation, so I don't need to raise your wages. But meanwhile, at the end of the month, there's a whole lot less money in their bank accounts. Now, the second observation, I think, which is very appropriate today, and I wrote a piece recently that our friend John Molden retook, so it's out there on the internet. But anybody who's interested can just email me for it at louis@gafgal.com. I wrote a piece called The Knowledge Revolution and Its Consequences. And basically, you know, Marx's main idea was that the political infrastructure reflects the economic superstructure, that basically whoever dominates the economy ends up building a political structure that suits its needs. And, you know, when Marx was writing this, he saw a huge conflict appearing because the economy had been for centuries basically dominated by the people who controlled the land. And the people who controlled the land in countries like Britain or France, et cetera, still controlled all the political power. Meanwhile, the economy had already shifted and was becoming more industrial. So there was tension here between, on the one hand, the political structure, which basically reflected the interests of the landowners, and an economic infrastructure where, you know, basically the economy was moving away from land and towards industry. In the UK, this was really epitomized by the debates over the Corn Laws, where basically the rich landowners had to, in essence, be turkeys that voted for Christmas. They had to accept free trade, even though it killed their own interests, because otherwise the workers were going to riot because they were, in essence, forced to pay for bread at a too high a price. Fast forward to today, and what do we have? I think, you know, if we think, okay, you had the Industrial Revolution 150 years ago. Today you have the Knowledge Revolution. Our economies are rapidly being transformed away from a sort of, you know, pyramid shaped where you have one leader on top and managers in the middle and an army of people at the bottom. Organizations are becoming more and more flat all around the world, and knowledge flows through much more quickly. Now, our parliamentary democracies were, in essence, the direct consequence of the industrialization of our countries. Now, you know, when we came through with our parliamentary democracies, it would take a week to go from Marseille to Paris. And, you know, if you were living in Marseille, you had no clue what was happening in Paris. So parliamentary democracy solved that in that you would choose a local doctor that you respected or a local lawyer that you respected or local trade unionist or a local judge or whatever. And he would go represent your community's interests in Washington, Ottawa, London, Paris, because the travel times are much too great. Today, however, to a large degree, politicians are by and large intermediaries, right? They're third party intermediaries. We know we need to make laws, and we send somebody to do it for us. But in a knowledge economy, do we really need all those people? Do we need this class of intermediaries? And I think in their guts, most people know that, you know, we've moved from the local doctor going off to Washington or Paris to represent you. And instead, we now have a professional class of politicians almost everywhere around the world who first and foremost think about their own interests. Now, the beauty of the internet is that it basically does away with intermediaries. And that's the problem for a lot of companies. A lot of business models that relied on being intermediaries are being decimated, whether it's your headhunter or your stockbroker. And if you've been an intermediary, you're struggling, except politicians. If you look at the Washington, D.C. real estate market, it's been the most buoyant of all markets in the U.S. over the past 20 years. So we have, you know, more and more government intermediaries. Well, really, we should be getting less and less. You know, why, if you live in, let's say, Kansas, do you need to send somebody to Washington to represent you now? You know exactly what's happening in Washington. You know, the reality is, in a knowledge economy that we're moving into, we don't really need representative democracy anymore. We should just move to direct democracy where, you know, just like the Swiss do, you have referendums on the various ideas once a weekend. You know, you get 50,000 signatures, you can put your idea to a referendum and move on. Now, some countries, I think, will evolve towards that. Others won't. Now, so what we'll have is we'll have politicians that will try to make themselves relevant, even though, you know, they're basically intermediaries we no longer need. They'll try to make themselves relevant, and they'll do it in one of two ways, either by trying to control information, which is what we're seeing in China, or by trying to basically spend money that isn't there to keep things going. But by spending money that isn't there, you come back to Jacques Rev's definition of inflation, which is inflation is subsidizing expenditures that give no return with money that doesn't exist. And everywhere around the world, this is what you're seeing. Basically, politicians trying to stay relevant by increasing budget deficits. But in so doing, what they're really doing is fueling inflation, which an inflation rate that is really hurting now the bottom rung of people.
Well, Louis, thanks for that detailed answer. I'm sure that we'll have a listener revolt if we get a co-founder of GavCal on and don't also get a market update. So please give us a quick review of what you see going on in the markets and what investors should be paying attention to.
Well, look, I think the biggest event of, as we discussed a couple of weeks ago, the biggest event of recent weeks is the Fed moving from QT to QE. And with the Fed moving from QT to QE, you now have the BOJ, the ECB, and the Fed all doing QE at the same time. This has never happened before. You have the Fed injecting liquidity at a time when median inflation in the U.S. and core CPI are at a 10-year high. This has never happened before. But perhaps most importantly, you have the Fed injecting liquidity at a time when budget deficits are going through the roof. So you have very stimulative fiscal policy and very stimulative monetary policy at the same time, you know, going back to this idea of spending money that you don't have. This is the only response that government have at this point to the popular anger, spending money they don't have, and they're doing it in spades. And they're now doing it almost everywhere around the world. To me, that's quite inflationary with the obvious consequences.
And let's translate that. If that's inflationary, does that mean gold is the place to be? Does that mean what? What are the implications for investors in terms of market positioning?
Well, definitely don't be in bonds to begin with. So I think the markets in the past few months have started to sense this. What have you started to see in recent months? You've seen the U.S. dollar topping out. You've seen the U.S. yield curve and yield curves elsewhere start to steepen. You've seen cyclicals outperform growth stocks. You've seen foreign markets outperform the U.S. As you see all this, I think the question is, okay, is this just a dead cat bounce from the structural trend that we've had for the past decade? Or is the trend now changing? I believe the trend is now changing. I believe you want to be long cyclicals. You don't want to be long bonds. And you want to basically own the things that will benefit from a weaker U.S. dollar. First and foremost, emerging markets. But yes, to your point, you can add gold to that list.
And as we close, I'm sure most of our listeners are already familiar with GavCal Research, but for the unlikely possibility that someone isn't, how can they learn more about what you do there?
Thank you very much. The best way is to either buy one of our books on Amazon. I've written a number of books. The other, of course, is just to come to our website, which is GavCal.com, GavEKAL.com.
Well, Louis, we look forward to getting you back in a month or so for another update. This episode of Macro Voices All-Stars was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com, my favorite podcast when it comes to quant and rules-based investing. And remember to head over and listen to my conversation with its host, Niels Kastrup Larsen, which we released on September 7th, 2019. To get the slide deck that Neil shared, head over to toptradersunplugged.com/macro slides. And as a listener of my show, you're also able to get Neil's latest book for free by going to toptradersunplugged.com/macro. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.